what exactly was he? As I was wrapping up my time with Witherington, I wanted him to sum it up for me. Taking all his research into consideration, what was his personal conclusion about who Jesus saw himself to be? I posed the question, sat back, and let him spell it out, which he did with eloquence and conviction. Jesus thought he was the person appointed by God to bring in the climactic saving act of God in human history. He believed he was the agent of God to carry that out, that he had been authorized by God, empowered by God. He spoke for God, and he was directed by God to do this task. So what Jesus said, God said. What Jesus did was the work of God. Under the Jewish concept of agency, a man's agent is as himself. Remember how Jesus sent out his apostles and said, "Whatever they do to you, they have done to me." There was a strong connection between a man and his agent, whom he sends on a mission. Well, Jesus believed he was on a divine mission, and the mission was to redeem the people of God. The implication is that the people of God were lost and that God had to do something, as he had always done, to intervene and set them back on the right track. But there was a difference this time. This was the last time. This was the last chance. Did Jesus believe he was the Son of God, the Anointed One of God? The answer is yes. Did he see himself as the Son of Man? The answer is yes. Did he see himself as the final Messiah? Yes, that's the way he viewed himself. Did he believe that anybody less than God could save the world? No, I don't believe he did. And here's where the paradox gets as quizzical as it can possibly get. The way God was going to save the world was by his Son dying, the most human of all human acts, to die. Now, God, in his divine nature, doesn't die. So how was God going to get this done? How was God going to be the Savior of the human race? He had to come as a human being to accomplish that task, and Jesus believed he was the one to do it. Jesus said in Mark 10:45, "I did not come to be served, but to serve, and give my life as a ransom in place of the many." This is either the highest form of megalomania, or it's the example of somebody who really believes, as he said, "I and the Father are one." In other words, "I have the authority to speak for the Father. I have the power to act for the Father. If you reject me, you've rejected the Father." Even if you eliminated the fourth gospel and just read the synoptics, this would still be the conclusion you would come to. And it is the conclusion that Jesus would have led us to if we had a Bible study and asked him this question. We have to ask, why is there no other first century Jew who has millions of followers today? Why isn't there a John the Baptist movement? Why, of all first century figures, including the Roman emperors, is Jesus still worshipped today, while the others have crumbled into the dust of history? It's because this Jesus, the historical Jesus, is also the living Lord. That's why. It's because he's still around, while the others are long gone. In the very place of God. Like Witherington, many other scholars have painstakingly picked apart the earliest evidence for Jesus and reached the same conclusions. Wrote Craig, "Here is a man who thought of himself as the Son of God in a unique sense, who claimed to act and speak with divine authority, who held himself to be a worker of miracles, and who believed that people's eternal destiny hinged on whether or not they believed in him." Then he added a remark that's especially startling. The clues sufficient for a high Christological self-understanding of Jesus are present even in the attenuated 20% of Jesus' sayings recognized by the members of the Jesus Seminar as authentic. The evidence for concluding that Jesus intended to stand in the very place of God is absolutely convincing, concurred theologian Royce Gordon Grunler. So extraordinary is Jesus' assertion, said Craig, that inevitably the issue of his sanity has to come up. He notes that after James Dunn completed his own epic study of this issue, Dunn was compelled to comment, "One last question cannot be ignored. Was Jesus mad?" At the airport in Lexington, waiting for my flight back to Chicago, I dropped coins into a payphone and called for an appointment to interview one of the country's leading experts on psychology. It was time to find out. 8. The psychological evidence. Was Jesus crazy when he claimed to be the Son of God? When a psychologist or psychiatrist testifies, he shall wear a cone-shaped hat that is not less than 2 feet tall. The surface of the hat shall be imprinted with stars and lightning bolts. Additionally, he shall be required to don a white beard that is not less than 18 inches in length and shall punctuate crucial elements of his testimony by stabbing the air with a wand. Whenever a psychologist or psychiatrist provides testimony, the bailiff shall contemporaneously dim the courtroom lights and administer 2 strikes to a Chinese gong. By suggesting this amendment to the state statutes in 1997, New Mexico State Senator Duncan Scott left no doubt about his attitude toward experts who testify that defendants are insane and therefore not legally responsible for their crimes. Apparently, Scott's cynicism was shared by a majority of his colleagues. They voted to approve his tongue-in-cheek proposal. The joke got as far as the House of Representatives, which eventually blocked it from becoming law. Admittedly, there's an undercurrent of skepticism in courthouses over psychiatrists and psychologists who testify concerning the mental state of defendants, their ability to cooperate with their attorney in preparing their defense, and whether they were legally insane at the time they committed their crime. Even so, most lawyers recognize that mental health professionals offer important insights for the criminal justice system. I recall a case in which a mild-mannered housewife stood accused of murdering her husband. At first glance, she appeared no different from anybody's mother. Well-dressed, pleasant, kindly, looking as if she had just emerged from baking a fresh batch of chocolate chip cookies for the neighborhood children. I scoffed when a psychologist testified she was mentally unable to stand trial. Then her lawyer put her on the witness stand. Initially, her testimony was clear, rational, and lucid. However, slowly it became more and more bizarre as she described, calmly and with great seriousness, how she had been assaulted by a succession of famous individuals, including Dwight Eisenhower and the ghost of Napoleon. By the time she finished, nobody in the courtroom doubted that she was totally out of touch with reality. The judge committed her to a mental institution until she was well enough to face the charges against her. Looks can be deceiving. It's the psychologist's job to peer beneath the defendant's veneer and draw conclusions concerning his or her mental condition. It's an inexact science, which means mistakes and even abuses can occur. But overall, psychological testimony provides important safeguards for defendants. How does all this relate to Jesus? In the preceding chapter, Dr. Ben Witherington III offered convincing evidence that even the earliest material about Jesus showed he was claiming to be God incarnate. That naturally raises the issue of whether Jesus was crazy when he made those assertions. In search of an expert's assessment of Jesus' mental state, I drove to a suburban Chicago office building to elicit testimony from one of the country's leading authorities on psychological issues. The 7th interview. Gary R. Collins, Ph.D. With a master's degree in psychology from the University of Toronto and a doctorate in clinical psychology from Purdue University, Collins has been studying, teaching, and writing about human behavior for 35 years. He was a professor of psychology at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School for 2 decades, most of that time as chairman of its psychology division. A live wire with boundless energy and enthusiasm, Collins is a prolific author. He has written nearly 150 articles for journals and other periodicals, and currently is editor of Christian Counseling Today and contributing editor of the Journal of Psychology and Theology. He also has produced an astounding 45 books on psychology-related topics, including The Magnificent Mind, Family Shock, Can You Trust Psychology?, and the classic textbook Christian Counseling, A Comprehensive Guide. In addition, he was general editor of the 30-volume Resources for Christian Counseling, a series of books for mental health professionals. I found Collins in his bright and airy office at the American Association of Christian Counselors, a 15,000-member society of which he is the president. With salt and pepper hair and silver-rimmed glasses, he was looking dapper in a maroon turtleneck sweater, herringbone sports jacket, and gray slacks. But, sorry, no pointy hat or flowing white beard. I started our interview by gesturing out the window, where snow was gently falling on evergreen trees. A few miles in that direction is a state mental institution, I said. If we were to go over there, I'm sure we'd find some people who claim that they're God. We'd say they were insane. Jesus said he was God. Was he crazy, too? If you want the short answer, Collins said with a chuckle, it's a no. But, I insisted, this is a legitimate topic that's worthy of further analysis. Experts say that people suffering from delusional psychosis may appear rational much of the time, yet can have grandiose beliefs that they are superlative individuals. Some can even attract followers who believe they're geniuses. Maybe that's what happened with Jesus, I suggested. Well, it's true that people with psychological difficulties will often claim to be somebody they're not, Collins replied as he clasped his hands behind his head. They'll sometimes claim to be Jesus himself, or the President of the United States, or someone else famous, like Lee Strobel, he quipped. However, he continued, psychologists don't just look at what a person says. They'll go much deeper than that. They'll look at a person's emotions, because disturbed individuals frequently show inappropriate depression, or they might be vehemently angry, or perhaps they're plagued with anxiety. But look at Jesus. He never demonstrated inappropriate emotions. For instance, he cried at the death of his friend Lazarus. That's natural for an emotionally healthy individual. He certainly got angry at times, I asserted. Yes, he did. But it was a healthy kind of anger at people taking advantage of the downtrodden by lining their pockets at the temple. He wasn't just irrationally ticked off because someone was annoying him. This was a righteous reaction against injustice and the blatant mistreatment of people. Other deluded people will have misperceptions, he added. They think people are watching them or trying to get them when they're not. They're out of contact with reality. They misperceive the actions of other people and accuse them of doing things they have no intention of ever doing. Again, we don't see this in Jesus. He was obviously in contact with reality. He wasn't paranoid, although he rightfully understood that there were some very real dangers around him. Or people with psychological difficulties may have thinking disorders. They can't carry on a logical conversation. They'll jump to faulty conclusions. They're irrational. We don't see this in Jesus. He spoke clearly, powerfully, and eloquently. He was brilliant and had absolutely amazing insights into human nature. Another sign of mental disturbances is unsuitable behavior, such as dressing oddly or being unable to relate socially to others. Jesus' behavior was quite in line with what would be expected, and he had deep and abiding relationships with a wide variety of people from different walks of life. He paused, although I sensed he wasn't finished yet. I prompted him to continue by asking, "What else do you observe about him?" Collins gazed out the window at the beautiful and peaceful snow-blanketed landscape. When he resumed, it was as if he were reminiscing about an old friend. He was loving, but didn't let his compassion immobilize him. He didn't have a bloated ego, even though he was often surrounded by adoring crowds. He maintained balance, despite an often demanding lifestyle. He always knew what he was doing and where he was going. He cared deeply about people, including women and children, who weren't seen as being important back then. He was able to accept people while not merely winking at their sin. He responded to individuals based on where they were at and what they uniquely needed. "So, doctor, your diagnosis?" I asked. All in all, I just don't see signs that Jesus was suffering from any known mental illness, he concluded, adding with a smile. He was much healthier than anyone else I know, including me. Raving mad. Granted, as we look back through history, we don't see obvious signs of delusion in Jesus. But what about people who were directly interacting with him? What did they see from their much closer vantage point? Some people who were on the scene in the first century would vehemently disagree with you, I pointed out to Collins. They did conclude that Jesus was crazy. John 10:20 tells us that many Jews thought he was demon-possessed and raving mad. Those are strong words. Yes, but that's hardly a diagnosis by a trained mental health professional, Collins countered. Look at what prompted those words. Jesus' moving and profound teaching about being the good shepherd. They were reacting because his assertions about himself were so far beyond their understanding of the norm, not because Jesus was truly mentally unbalanced. And notice that their comments were immediately challenged by others who said in verse 21, "These are not the sayings of a man possessed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind?" Why is that significant, I asked. Because Jesus wasn't just making outrageous claims about himself. He was backing them up with miraculous acts of compassion, like healing the blind. You see, if I claimed to be the president of the United States, that would be crazy. You'd look at me and see none of the trappings of the office of president. I wouldn't look like the president. People wouldn't accept my authority as president. No Secret Service agents would be guarding me. But if the real president claimed to be president, that wouldn't be crazy because he is president, and there would be plenty of confirming evidence of that. In an analogous way, Jesus didn't just claim to be God. He backed it up with amazing feats of healing, with astounding demonstrations of power over nature, with transcendent and unprecedented teaching, with divine insights into people, and ultimately with his own resurrection from the dead, which absolutely nobody else has been able to duplicate. So when Jesus claimed to be God, it wasn't crazy, it was the truth. However, Collins' appeal to Jesus' miracles opened the door to other objections. Some people have tried to shoot down these miracles that supposedly help authenticate Jesus' claim to being the Son of God, I said, pulling out a book from my briefcase. I read in the words of skeptic Charles Templeton. Many illnesses, then as now, were psychosomatic and could be cured when the sufferer's perception changed. Just as today a placebo prescribed by a physician in whom the patient has faith can effect an apparent cure, so, in an early time, faith in the healer could banish adverse symptoms. With each success, the healer's reputation would grow and his powers would, as a consequence, become more efficacious. Does this, I demanded, explain away the miracles that supposedly back up Jesus' claim to being the Son of God? Collins' reaction surprised me. I wouldn't have a whole lot of disagreement with what Templeton wrote, Collins replied. You wouldn't? Not really. Might Jesus have sometimes healed by suggestion? I have no problem with that. Sometimes people can have a psychologically induced illness, and if they get a new purpose for living, a new direction, they don't need the illness anymore. The placebo effect? If you think you're going to get better, you often do get better. That's a well-established medical fact, and when people came to Jesus, they believed he could heal them, so he did. But the fact remains, regardless of how he did it, Jesus did heal them. Of course, he quickly added, that doesn't explain all of Jesus' healings. Often a psychosomatic healing takes time. Jesus' healings were spontaneous. Many times people who are healed psychologically have their symptoms return a few days later, but we don't see any evidence of this. And Jesus healed conditions like lifelong blindness and leprosy, for which a psychosomatic explanation isn't very likely. On top of that, he brought people back from the dead, and death is not a psychologically induced state. Plus, you have all of his nature miracles, the calming of the sea, turning water into wine. They defy naturalistic answers. Well, maybe. However, Collins' mention of the miracle of turning water into wine brought up another possible explanation of Jesus' amazing feats. Jesus the hypnotist. Have you ever seen a stage hypnotist give water to someone they've put in a trance and then suggest to them that they were drinking wine? They smack their lips, they get giddy, they start feeling intoxicated just as if they were swigging a cheap Bordeaux. British author Ian Wilson has raised the question of whether this is how Jesus convinced the wedding guests at Cana that he had transformed jugs of water into the finest fermented libation. In fact, Wilson discusses the possibility that Jesus may have been a master hypnotist, which could explain the supposedly supernatural aspects of his life. For instance, hypnosis could account for his exorcisms, his transfiguration, during which three of his followers saw his face glow and his garments shine as white as light, and even his healings. As evidence, Wilson cites the modern example of a 16-year-old boy whose serious skin disorder was inexplicably healed through hypnotic suggestion. Perhaps Lazarus wasn't really brought back from the dead. Couldn't he have been in a death-like trance that had been induced by hypnosis? As for the resurrection, Jesus could have effectively conditioned the disciples to hallucinate his appearances in response to certain prearranged cues, the breaking of bread, for a predetermined period after his death, Wilson speculated. This would even explain the enigmatic reference in the Gospels to Jesus' inability to perform many miracles in his hometown of Nazareth. Said Wilson, "Jesus failed precisely where, as a hypnotist, we would most expect him to fail, among those who knew him best, those who had seen him grow up as an ordinary child. Largely responsible for any hypnotist's success rate are the awe and mystery with which he surrounds himself, and these essential factors would have been entirely lacking in Jesus' hometown." "You have to admit," I said to Collins, "that this is a rather interesting way of trying to explain away Jesus' miracles." There was a look of incredulity on his face. "This guy has a whole lot more faith in hypnosis than I do," he exclaimed. "While it's a clever argument, it just doesn't stand up to analysis. It's full of holes." One by one, Collins began to enumerate them. "First, there's the problem of a whole bunch of people being hypnotized. Not everybody is equally susceptible. Stage hypnotists will talk in a certain soothing tone of voice to the audience and watch for people who seem to be responding, and then they'll pick these people as their volunteers because they're readily susceptible to hypnosis. In a big group, many people are resistant. When Jesus multiplied the bread and fish, there were 5,000 witnesses. How could he have hypnotized them all? Second, hypnosis doesn't generally work on people who are skeptics and doubters. So how did Jesus hypnotize his brother James, who doubted him, but later saw the resurrected Christ? How did he hypnotize Saul of Tarsus, the opponent of Christianity, who never even met Jesus until he saw him after his resurrection? How did he hypnotize Thomas, who was so skeptical he wouldn't believe in the resurrection until he put his fingers in the nail holes in Jesus' hands? Third, concerning the resurrection, hypnosis wouldn't explain the empty tomb. I jumped in. "I suppose someone could claim that the disciples had been hypnotized to imagine the tomb was empty," I offered. "Even if that were possible," Collins replied, "Jesus certainly couldn't have hypnotized the Pharisees and Roman authorities, and they would have gladly produced his body if it had remained in the tomb. The fact that they didn't tells us the tomb was really empty. Fourth, look at the miracle of turning water into wine. Jesus never addressed the wedding guests. He didn't even suggest to the servants that the water had been turned into wine. He merely told them to take some water to the master of the banquet. He's the one who tasted it and said it was wine with no prior prompting. Fifth, the skin healing that Wilson talks about wasn't spontaneous, was it?" "Actually," I said, "the British Medical Journal says it took 5 days after the hypnosis for the reptilian skin, called ichthyosis, to fall off the teenager's left arm, and several more days for the skin to appear normal. The hypnotic success rate for dealing with other parts of his body over a period of several weeks was 50% to 95%. "Compare that," Collins said, "with Jesus healing 10 lepers in Luke 17. They were instantaneously healed, and 100%. That's not explainable merely by hypnosis. And neither is his healing of a man with a shriveled hand in Mark 3. Even if people were in a trance and merely thought his hand had been healed, eventually they would have found out the truth. hypnosis doesn't last a real long time. And finally, the Gospels record all sorts of details about what Jesus said and did, but never once do they portray him as saying or doing anything that would suggest he was hypnotizing people. Now, I could go on and on. I laughed. I told you it was an interesting explanation. I didn't say it was convincing, I said. Yet, books are being written to advance these kinds of ideas.
It's just amazing to me,
Collins replied, how people will grasp at anything to try to disprove Jesus' miracles. Jesus the Exorcist. Before we finished our interview, I wanted to tap into Collins' psychological expertise in one more area that skeptics find troubling. Jesus was an exorcist, I observed. He talked to demons and cast them out of the people they supposedly possessed. But is it really rational to believe that evil spirits are responsible for some illnesses and bizarre behavior? Collins wasn't disturbed by the question. From my theological beliefs, I accept that demons exist, he replied. We live in a society in which many people believe in angels. They know there are spiritual forces out there, and it's not too hard to conclude that some might be malevolent. Where you see God working, sometimes those forces are more active, and that's what was probably going on in the time of Jesus. I noticed Collins had referred to his theological beliefs and not his clinical experience. Have you, as a psychologist, ever seen clear evidence of the demonic? I asked.
I haven't personally, but then I haven't spent my whole career in clinical settings, he said. My friends in clinical work have said that sometimes they have seen this, and these are not people who are inclined to see a demon behind every problem. They tend to be skeptical. The psychiatrist M. Scott Peck wrote a bit about this kind of thing in his book, People of the Lie.
I pointed out that Ian Wilson, in suggesting that Jesus may have used hypnosis to cure people who only believed they were possessed, said dismissively that no realistic individual would explain a state of possession as the work of real demons.
That to some degree you find what you set out to find, Collins said in response. People who deny the existence of the supernatural will find some way, no matter how far-fetched, to explain a situation apart from the demonic. They'll keep giving medication, keep drugging the person, but he or she doesn't get better. There are cases that don't respond to normal medical or psychiatric treatment.
Could Jesus' exorcisms really have been psychosomatic healings? I asked.
Yes, in some cases. But again, you have to look at the whole context. What about the man who was possessed and Jesus sent the demons into the pigs and the pigs ran off the cliff? What's going on if that was a psychosomatic situation? I think Jesus really did drive out demons, and I think some people do that today. At the same time, we shouldn't be too quick to jump to a demonic conclusion when faced with a recalcitrant problem. As C.S. Lewis put it, there are two equal and opposite errors we can fall into concerning demons. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased with both errors. You know, Gary, that idea might fly with the American Association of Christian Counselors, but would secular psychologists consider it rational to believe in the demonic? I asked. I thought Collins might take offense at the question, which came out sounding more condescending than I had intended, but he didn't. It's interesting how things are changing, he mused. Our society today is caught up in spirituality. That's a term that can mean almost anything, but it does recognize the supernatural. It's very interesting what psychologists are believing in these days. Some are into Eastern mystical stuff. Some talk about the power of shamans to influence people's lives. Whereas 25 years ago, the suggestion of demonic activity would have been immediately dismissed, many psychologists are beginning to recognize that maybe there are more things in heaven and earth than our philosophies can account for.
Preposterous imagination. Collins and I had drifted a bit from the original point of our interview. As I thought about our talk while I was driving home, I returned to the central issue that had brought me to him. Jesus claimed to be God. Nobody is suggesting he was intentionally deceptive. And now Collins has concluded, based on 35 years of psychological experience, that he was not mentally impaired. However, that left me with a new question.
did Jesus fulfill the attributes of God? After all, it's one thing to claim divinity. It's quite another to embody the characteristics that make God, God. At a stoplight, I pulled a notebook out of my briefcase and scrawled a note to myself. Track down D.A. Carson. I knew that I'd want to talk to one of the country's leading theologians about this next matter. In the meantime, my talk with Gary Collins prompted me to spend time that night carefully rereading the discourses of Jesus. I could detect no sign of dementia, delusions, or paranoia. On the contrary, I was moved once more by his profound wisdom, his uncanny insights, his poetic eloquence, and his deep compassion. Historian Philip Schaff said it better than I can. "Is such an intellect, clear as the sky, bracing as the mountain air, sharp and penetrating as a sword, thoroughly healthy and vigorous, always ready and always self-possessed, liable to a radical and most serious delusion concerning his own character and mission? Preposterous imagination." 9. The profile evidence. Did Jesus fulfill the attributes of God? Shortly after 8 student nurses were murdered in a Chicago apartment, the trembling, lone survivor huddled with a police sketch artist and described in detail the killer she had seen from her secret vantage point beneath a bed. Quickly, the drawing was flashed around the city, to police officers, to hospitals, to transit stations, to the airport. Soon, an emergency room physician called detectives to say he was treating a man who looked suspiciously like the flinty-eyed fugitive depicted in the sketch. That's how police arrested a drifter named Richard Speck, who was promptly convicted of the heinous slayings and ended up dying in prison 30 years later. Ever since Scotland Yard first turned a witness's recollections into a sketch of a murder suspect in 1889, forensic artists have played an important role in law enforcement. Today, more than 300 sketch artists work with U.S. police agencies, and an increasing number of departments are relying on a computerized system called EFIT, Electronic Facial Identification Technique. This recently developed technology was successfully used to solve a 1997 kidnapping that occurred at a shopping mall just a few miles from my suburban Chicago home. The victim provided details about the kidnapper's appearance to a technician who used a computer to create an electronic likeness of the offender by choosing from different styles of noses, mouths, hairlines, and so forth. Just moments after the drawing was faxed to police agencies throughout the area, an investigator in another suburb recognized the picture as a dead ringer for a criminal he had encountered earlier. Fortunately, this led to a quick arrest of the kidnapping suspect. Oddly enough, the concept of an artist's drawing can provide a rough analogy that can help us in our quest for the truth about Jesus. Here's how. The Old Testament provides numerous details about God that sketch out in great specificity what He's like. For instance, God is described as omnipresent, or existing everywhere in the universe, as omniscient, or knowing everything that can be known throughout eternity, as omnipotent, or all-powerful, as eternal, or being both beyond time and the source of all time, and as immutable, or unchanging in his attributes. He's loving, he's holy, he's righteous, he's wise, he's just. Now, Jesus claims to be God. But does he fulfill these characteristics of deity? In other words, if we examine Jesus carefully, does his likeness closely match the sketch of God that we find elsewhere in the Bible? If it doesn't, we can conclude that his claim to being God is false. This is an extremely complex and mind-stretching issue. For example, when Jesus was delivering the Sermon on the Mount on a hillside outside Capernaum, he wasn't simultaneously standing on Main Street of Jericho. So in what sense could he be called omnipresent? How can he be called omniscient if he readily admits in Mark 13:32 that he doesn't know everything about the future? If he's eternal, why does Colossians 1:15 call him the firstborn over all creation? On the surface, these issues seem to suggest that Jesus doesn't resemble the sketch of God. Nevertheless, I've learned over the years that initial impressions can be deceiving. That's why I was glad to be able to discuss these issues with Dr. D. A. Carson, the theologian who has emerged in recent years as one of the most distinguished thinkers in Christianity. The Eighth Interview, Donald A. Carson, Ph.D. D. A. Carson, a research professor of New Testament at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, has written or edited more than 40 books, including The Sermon on the Mount, Exegetical Fallacies, The Gospel According to John, and his award-winning The Gagging of God. He can read a dozen languages. His mastery of French stems from a childhood spent in Quebec, and is a member of the Tyndale Fellowship for Biblical Research, the Society for Biblical Literature, and the Institute for Biblical Research. His areas of expertise include the historical Jesus, postmodernism, Greek grammar, and the theology of the Apostles Paul and John. After initially studying chemistry, receiving a Bachelor of Science degree from McGill University, Carson went on to receive a Master of Divinity degree before going to England, where he earned a doctorate in New Testament at prestigious Cambridge University. He taught at three other colleges and seminaries before joining Trinity in 1978. I had never met Carson before I drove onto Trinity's Deerfield, Illinois campus for our interview. Frankly, I was expecting a starched academic. But while I found Carson to be every bit the scholar I had anticipated, I was taken aback by his warm, sincere, and pastoral tone as he responded to what turned out to be, in some cases, rather caustic questions. Our conversation was held in an otherwise deserted faculty lounge over Christmas break. Carson was wearing a white windbreaker over a button-down shirt, blue jeans, and Adidas. After some preliminary banter about our mutual appreciation of England, Carson has lived there off and on through the years, and his wife Joy is British, I pulled out my notebook, started my recorder, and posed a background question to help determine whether Jesus has the right stuff to be God. Living and forgiving like God. My initial question centered on why Carson thinks Jesus is God in the first place. What did he say or do, I asked, that convinces you that he is divine? I wasn't sure how he would respond, although I anticipated he would focus on Jesus' supernatural feats. I was wrong. One could point to such things as his miracles, Carson said as he leaned back in his comfortably upholstered chair. But other people have done miracles, so while this may be indicative, it's not decisive. Of course, the resurrection was the ultimate vindication of his identity, but of the many things he did, one of the most striking to me is his forgiving of sin. Really, I said, shifting in my chair, which was perpendicular to his, in order to face him more directly. How so? The point is, if you do something against me, I have the right to forgive you. However, if you do something against me and somebody else comes along and says, I forgive you, what kind of cheek is that? The only person who can say that sort of thing meaningfully is God himself, because sin, even if it is against other people, is first and foremost a defiance of God and his laws. When David sinned by committing adultery and arranging the death of the woman's husband, he ultimately says to God in Psalm 51, Against you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight. He recognized that although he had wronged people, in the end he had sinned against the God who made him in his image, and God needed to forgive him. So along comes Jesus and says to sinners, I forgive you. The Jews immediately recognize the blasphemy of this. They react by saying, Who can forgive sins but God alone? To my mind, that is one of the most striking things Jesus did. Not only did Jesus forgive sin, I observed, but he asserted that he himself was without sin, and certainly sinlessness is an attribute of deity. Yes, he replied. Historically in the West, people considered most holy have also been the most conscious of their own failures and sins. They are people who are aware of their shortcomings and lusts and resentments, and they are fighting them honestly by the grace of God. In fact, they're fighting them so well that others take notice and say, There is a holy man or woman. But along comes Jesus, who can say with a straight face, Which of you can convict me of sin? If I said that, my wife and children and all who know me would be glad to stand up and testify, whereas no one could with respect to Christ.
Although moral perfection and the forgiveness of sin are undoubtedly characteristics of deity, there are several additional attributes that Jesus must fulfill if he is to match the sketch of God. It was time to progress to those. After having started by lobbing softballs at Carson, I got ready to throw some curves. Mystery of the Incarnation. Using some notes I had brought along, I hit Carson in rapid-fire succession with some of the biggest obstacles to Jesus' claim of deity. Dr. Carson, how in the world could Jesus be omnipresent if he couldn't be in two places at once? I asked. How could he be omniscient when he says, "Not even the Son of Man knows the hour of his return"? How could he be omnipotent when the Gospels plainly tell us that he was unable to do many miracles in his hometown? Pointing my pen at him for emphasis, I concluded by saying, "Let's admit it. The Bible itself seems to argue against Jesus being God." While Carson didn't flinch, he did concede that these questions have no simple answers. After all, they strike at the very heart of the Incarnation. God becoming man, Spirit taking on flesh, the infinite becoming finite, the eternal becoming time-bound. It's a doctrine that has kept theologians busy for centuries. And that's where Carson chose to start his answer, by going back to the way scholars have tried to respond to these matters through the years. Historically, there have been two or three approaches to this, he began, sounding a bit as if he were beginning a classroom lecture. For example, at the end of the last century, the great theologian Benjamin Warfield worked through the Gospels and ascribed various bits either to Christ's humanity or to his deity. When Jesus does something that's a reflection of him being God, that's ascribed to Christ's deity. When there's something reflecting his limitations or finiteness or his humanness, for example, his tears, does God cry? That's ascribed to his humanity. That explanation was fraught with problems, it seemed to me. If you do that, wouldn't you end up with a schizophrenic Jesus? I asked. It's easy to slip into that unwittingly, he replied. All the confessional statements have insisted that both Jesus' humanity and his deity remained distinct, yet they combined in one person. So you want to avoid a solution in which there are essentially two minds, sort of a Jesus-human mind and a Christ-heavenly mind. However, this is one kind of solution, and there may be something to it. The other kind of solution is some form of kenosis, which means emptying. This spins out of Philippians 2, where Paul tells us that Jesus, being in the form of God, did not think equality with God was something to be exploited. That's the way it should be translated. But emptied himself. He became a nobody. That seemed a little ambiguous to me. Can you be more explicit? I asked. What exactly did he empty himself of? Apparently, I had put my finger on the issue. Ah, that's the question, Carson replied with a nod. Through the centuries, people have given various answers to that. For instance, did he empty himself of his deity? Well, then he would no longer be God. Did he empty himself of the attributes of his deity? I have a problem with that, too, because it's difficult to separate attributes from reality. If you have an animal that looks like a horse, smells like a horse, walks like a horse, and has all the attributes of a horse, you've got a horse. So I don't know what it means for God to empty himself of his attributes and still be God. Some have said he didn't empty himself of his attributes, but he emptied himself of the use of his attributes. A self-limiting type of thing. That's getting closer. Although there are times when that was not what he was doing, he was forgiving sins the way only God can, which is an attribute of deity. Others go further by saying he emptied himself of the independent use of his attributes. That is, he functioned like God when his heavenly Father gave him explicit sanction to do so. Now that's much closer. The difficulty is that there is a sense in which the eternal Son has always acted in line with his Father's commandments. You don't want to lose that, even in eternity past. But it's getting closer. I sensed we were somewhere in the vicinity of the bullseye, but I wasn't sure we were going to get much closer. That seemed to be Carson's sentiment, too. Strictly speaking, he said,
Philippians 2 does not tell us precisely what the eternal Son emptied himself of. He emptied himself. He became a nobody. Some kind of emptying is at issue, but let's be frank. You're talking about the incarnation, one of the central mysteries of the Christian faith. You're dealing with formless, bodiless, omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent spirit and finite, touchable, physical, time-bound creatures. For one to become the other inevitably binds you up in mysteries. So part of Christian theology has been concerned not with explaining it all away, but with trying to take the biblical evidence and, retaining all of it fairly, find ways of synthesis that are rationally coherent, even if they're not exhaustively explanatory. That was a sophisticated way of saying that theologians can come up with explanations that seem to make sense, even though they might not be able to explain every nuance about the incarnation. In a way, that seemed logical. If the incarnation is true, it's not surprising that finite minds couldn't totally comprehend it. It seemed to me that some sort of voluntary emptying of Jesus' independent use of his attributes was reasonable in explaining why he generally didn't exhibit the omnis, omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence, in his earthly existence, even though the New Testament clearly states that all these qualities are ultimately true of him. That, however, was only part of the problem. I flipped to the next page of my notes and began another line of questioning about some specific biblical passages that seemed to directly contradict Jesus' claim to being God. Creator or created? Part of the sketch that Jesus must match is that God is an uncreated being who has existed from eternity past. Isaiah 57:15 describes God as He who lives forever. But, I said to Carson, there are some verses that seem to strongly suggest that Jesus was a created being. For instance, I said, John 3:16 calls Jesus the begotten Son of God, and Colossians 1:15 says he was the firstborn over all creation. Don't they clearly imply that Jesus was created, as opposed to being the Creator? One of Carson's areas of expertise is Greek grammar, which he called upon in responding to both of those verses. Let's take John 3:16, he said. It's the King James Version that translates the Greek with the words, His only begotten Son. Those who consider this the correct rendering usually bind that up with the incarnation itself, that is, his begetting in the Virgin Mary. But in fact, that's not what the word in Greek means. It really means unique one. The way it was usually used in the first century is unique and beloved. So John 3:16 is simply saying that Jesus is the unique and beloved Son, or, as the New International Version translates it, the one and only Son, rather than saying that he's ontologically begotten in time. That only explains that one passage I pointed out. Okay, let's look at the Colossians verse, which uses the term firstborn. The vast majority of commentators, whether conservative or liberal, recognize that in the Old Testament, the firstborn, because of the laws of succession, normally received the lion's share of the estate, or the firstborn would become king in the case of a royal family. The firstborn, therefore, was the one ultimately with all the rights of the father. By the second century before Christ, there are places where the word no longer has any notion of actual begetting or of being born first, but carries the idea of the authority that comes with the position of being the rightful heir. That's the way it applies to Jesus, as virtually all scholars admit. In light of that, the very expression firstborn is slightly misleading. What would be a better translation, I asked. I think supreme heir would be more appropriate, he responded. While that would explain the Colossians passage, Carson went even further with one last point. If you're going to quote Colossians 1:15, you have to keep it in context by going on to Colossians 2:9, where the very same author stresses, For in Christ all the fullness of the deity lives in bodily form. The author wouldn't contradict himself. So the term firstborn cannot exclude Jesus' eternality, since that is part of what it means to possess the fullness of the divine. For me, that nailed the issue. But there were other troubling passages as well. For example, in Mark 10, someone addresses Jesus as good teacher, prompting him to reply, "Why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone." Wasn't he denying his divinity by saying this, I asked? No, I think he was trying to get the fellow to stop and think about what he was saying, Carson explained. The parallel passage in Matthew is a little more expansive and does not find Jesus downplaying his deity at all. I think all he's saying is, "Wait a minute, why are you calling me good? Is this just a polite thing, like you say, good day? What do you mean by good? You call me good master, is this because you're trying to honey up to me?" In a fundamental sense, there's only one who is good, and that's God. But Jesus is not implicitly saying, "So don't call me that." He's saying, "Do you really understand what you're saying when you say that? Are you really ascribing to me what should only be ascribed to God?" That could be teased out to mean, "I really am what you say. You speak better than you know." Or, "Don't you dare call me that. Next time, call me Sinner Jesus like everybody else does." In terms of all that Jesus says and does elsewhere, which way does it make sense to take it? With so many verses that call Jesus sinless, holy, righteous, innocent, undefiled, and separate from sinners, the answer was pretty obvious. Was Jesus a lesser God? If Jesus was God, what kind of God was he? Was he equal to the Father or some sort of junior God, possessing the attributes of deity and yet somehow failing to match the total sketch that the Old Testament provides of the divine? That question comes out of another passage that I pointed out to Carson. Jesus said in John 14:28, "The Father is greater than I." Some people look at this and conclude that Jesus must have been a lesser God. Are they right? I asked. Carson sighed. My father was a preacher, and a dictum in our home when I was growing up was, "A text without a context becomes a pretext for a proof text." It's very important to see this passage in its context. The disciples are moaning because Jesus has said he's going away. Jesus says, "If you loved me, you'd be glad for my sake when I say I'm going away, because the Father is greater than I." That is to say, Jesus is returning to the glory that is properly his. So if they really know who he is and really love him properly, they'll be glad that he's going back to the realm where he really is greater. Jesus says in John 17:5, "Glorify me with the glory that I had with the Father before the world began." That is, the Father is greater than I. When you use a category like greater, it doesn't have to mean ontologically greater. If I say, for example, that the President of the United States is greater than I'm not saying he's an ontologically superior being. He's greater in military capability, political prowess, and public acclaim, but he's not more of a man than I am. He's a human being, and I'm a human being. So when Jesus says, "The Father is greater than I," one must look at the context and ask if Jesus is saying, "The Father is greater than I because he's God and I'm not." Frankly, that would be a pretty ridiculous thing to say. Suppose I got up on some podium to preach and said, "I solemnly declare to you that God is greater than I am." That would be a rather useless observation. The comparison is only meaningful if they're already on the same plane and there's some delimitation going on. Jesus is in the limitations of the incarnation. He's going to the cross. He's going to die. But he's about to return to the Father and to the glory he had with the Father before the world began. He's saying, "You guys are moaning for my sake. You ought to be glad because I'm going home." It's in that sense that the Father is greater than I. "So," I said, "this isn't an implicit denial of his deity." "No," he concluded, "it's really not. The context makes that clear." While I was ready to accept the fact that Jesus was not a lesser God, I had a different and more sensitive issue to raise. How could Jesus be a compassionate God, yet endorse the idea of eternal suffering for those who reject him? The disquieting question of hell. The Bible says that the Father is loving, The New Testament affirms the same about Jesus. But can they really be loving while at the same time sending people to hell? After all, Jesus teaches more about hell than anyone in the entire Bible. Doesn't that contradict his supposed gentle and compassionate character? In posing this question to Carson, I quoted the hard-edged words of agnostic Charles Templeton. How could a loving Heavenly Father create an endless hell and, over the centuries, consign millions of people to it because they do not or cannot or will not accept certain religious beliefs? That question, though tweaked for maximum impact, didn't raise Carson's ire. He began with a clarification. First of all, he said, I'm not sure that God simply casts people into hell because they don't accept certain beliefs. He thought for a moment, then backed up to take a run at a more thorough answer by discussing a subject that many modern people consider a quaint anachronism, sin. Picture God in the beginning of creation with a man and a woman made in his image, Carson said. They wake up in the morning and think about God. They love him, truly. They delight to do what he wants. It's their whole pleasure. They're rightly related to him and they're rightly related to each other. Then, with the entrance of sin and rebellion into the world, these image-bearers begin to think that they are at the center of the universe. Not literally, but that's the way they think, and that's the way we think. All the things we call social pathologies, war, rape, bitterness, nurtured envy, secret jealousies, pride, inferiority complexes, are bound up in the first instance with the fact that we're not rightly related with God. The consequence is that people get hurt. From God's perspective, that is shockingly disgusting. So what should God do about it? If he says, well, I don't give a rip, he's saying that evil doesn't matter to him. It's a bit like saying, oh, yeah, the Holocaust. I don't care. Wouldn't we be shocked if we thought God didn't have moral judgments on such matters? But in principle, if he's the sort of God who has moral judgments on those matters, he's got to have moral judgments on this huge matter of all these divine image-bearers shaking their puny fists at his face and singing with Frank Sinatra, I did it my way. That's the real nature of sin. Having said that, hell is not a place where people are consigned because they were pretty good blokes but just didn't believe the right stuff. They're consigned there, first and foremost, because they defy their Maker and want to be at the center of the universe. Hell is not filled with people who have already repented. Only God isn't gentle enough or good enough to let them out. It's filled with people who, for all eternity, still want to be at the center of the universe and who persist in their God-defying rebellion. What has God to do? If he says it doesn't matter to him, God is no longer a God to be admired. He's either amoral or positively creepy. For him to act in any other way in the face of such blatant defiance would be to reduce God himself. I interjected, yes, but what seems to bother people the most is the idea that God will torment people for eternity. That seems vicious, doesn't it? Replied Carson. In the first place, the Bible says that there are different degrees of punishment, so I'm not sure that it's the same level of intensity for all people. In the second place, if God took his hands off this fallen world so that there were no restraint on human wickedness, we would make hell. Thus, if you allow a whole lot of sinners to live somewhere in a confined place where they're not doing damage to anyone but themselves, what do you get but hell? There's a sense in which they're doing it to themselves, and it's what they want because they still don't repent. I thought Carson was finished with his answer because he hesitated for a moment. However, he had one more crucial point. One of the things that the Bible does insist is that in the end, not only will justice be done, but justice will be seen to be done so that every mouth will be stopped. I grabbed a hold of that last statement. In other words, I said, at the time of judgment, there's nobody in the world who will walk away from that experience saying that they have been treated unfairly by God. Everyone will recognize the fundamental justice in the way God judges them and the world. That's right, Carson said firmly. Justice is not always done in this world. We see that every day. But on the last day, it will be done for all to see, and no one will be able to complain by saying, "This isn't fair."
This concludes this disc. Please proceed to Disc 7 for the continuation of the program.